Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain and Anne Guest.
Welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. We are up to episode number 140. I'm Paul Spain.
I'm Paul Brislin.
And I'm Chris Gardner.
Welcome along. Great to have you both here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, Paul, just as a reminder, maybe you can let everyone know where you fit into the technology and telecommunications sector here in New Zealand.
I'm the chief executive of 2ANZ, which is the Telecommunication Users Association. So we try to represent users, customers of telcos, and remind the government and the telecommunication companies that without us, there wouldn't be much use in building all their shiny networks.
Well, thank you for doing that job. We appreciate it.
That's quite all right.
And Chris?
I'm technology editor at the Waikato Times in Hamilton.
Great to have both of you back. Now, something very fascinating has been on Kickstarter in the last little while, and it's due to end. The Kickstarter campaign is due to end in the next few days, and this is the Tile. Now, Paul, you spotted this.
Well, this is a little. It's a device. It's about the size of a postage stamp, maybe three or four credit cards thick, and it is in essence a tiny little GPS tracking unit. Which you can attach to your keys or tuck away on your bicycle somewhere is how they promote it. If you lose your keys or somebody nicks your bike, you simply use an app on your iPhone, and it's only iPhone at this stage, very similar to Find My iPhone, but it finds your device instead, or your lost keys, or your bicycle, or your dog, or whatever's gone missing.
Yeah, now this threw me when I first saw this a little while back, and the whole concept to me just didn't sound like it would work. So I sort of didn't look in any further. When you mentioned it again, we've had a look through, and it seems like what it uses is very low power Bluetooth 4, which is part of the reason why you need an iPhone to be able to access it. So I think it uses that rather than actually traditional GPS technology. And the way you track it, if it's something that you've lost, say their example was a bicycle that got stolen, everyone that runs their app is actually
actively
scan
for
things that you mark as lost.
So the idea there then is that you have to have as many of these things out there and as many people with the app on their phone as possible in order to make it work at its most basic level.
So it talks about a range of 50 to 150 meters. So if you've lost your keys, it'll tell you as you're getting warmer or colder.
Like. Yeah, and it'll play a sound
which is a cool idea. Yeah. And you can get them to beep, right? So you can let them know. And 1 year battery life.
That's right. So at the end of the year, presumably you send it back and organize for another one to be shipped out. And at the moment, there are $20.
$20 US, $14 New Zealand shipping.
Yeah, which is not too bad.
No, well, I'll be ordering one to have a little bit of a look.
Have a little bit of a tutu.
Yeah, Chris, are you going to grab one?
Maybe.
It's not going to work with your Windows phone, is it?
No, you've got to
have an iPhone or an iPad or an iPod Touch 5
presumably
to use it.
Yeah, exactly. But that'll broaden out once support for Bluetooth 4.0
Once Bluetooth 4 comes to Android and Windows Phone and so on, I imagine we'll probably see it come more broadly.
Yeah. It's an interesting model, isn't it? And it's sort of the marriage of crowdsourcing, not just in terms of raising the money for it, but in terms of actually deploying the product. But also taking, as Chris said, taking something that's embedded already in your iPhone or any of the smartphones these days and extending it out into the physical world.
Now, the fascinating number is, they were aiming for about $20,000 in funding off Kickstarter. Now, they probably knew that they were going to blow this out of the water and maybe, created it artificially low. Yeah. I don't know. But they were aiming for $20,000 in funding. How much have they ended up with?
As of today, they've got 21,000 backers and they've got $1.15 million US dollars. So they're 5,746% backed.
Yeah. Well,
bloody marvellous.
Well done.
As I said before we recorded, though, this... In the video, they're sort of trying to say this is innovative. I don't think it really is. It really is just copying a technology that's already in the iPhone and extending it to anything. So
I haven't seen anyone else that's done something quite like this, and that was why at first I wrote it off, because I couldn't actually see how they would get it to work. How can you have this little postage stamp type thing with a battery in it that's going to last for a year and actually be usable? I mean, I think some of their examples of how you might use it possibly a little bit far-fetched, and one of the examples was it was attached to one of the people in their video, it was attached to her MacBook, And you can imagine if someone stole your MacBook, they'd probably quickly...
First thing to go would be the tile.
They would tear that off. But if you're wondering where you've left it in the house or in the office, really very, very forgetful, that could be pretty handy.
I'm thinking about my set of keys or the house key, you know, I'm forever leaving something behind, for that kind of level. For $20, you know, I'd give it a whirl.
And a good little gift as well. So if you order one of these, I think they're going to be ready sort of around the end of the year, early-ish next year, that sort of time frame. So, bit of fun. There was a bit of an announcement this morning, or the release of a new report.
Mm.
Now, Paul, you were there to hear what the government had to say.
That's right.
Two government ministers actually.
It was a two minister morning. Yes,
it's quite an important quite an important event when you get two ministers out of bed
that's
early.
Right. That's right.
What were the highlights from your perspective? Is this report worthwhile for starters? Is it going to spur any good things on?
Well, I hope so. This is the ICT sector report. So the government's looked at the economy, split it into six or seven sectors, and this is the first report off the blocks. And it's a good look at how much value there is in the ICT sector here in New Zealand. So it gives us a very good benchmark, if you like, for where we're going from here. So there's talk of them doing it every year, and I'd encourage that because it's important, I think, that if we want to know how we're doing, we've got to measure things. And the report breaks down the sector in terms of value to the economy, how many people it employs, all that sort of thing, all the good juicy stats that you want to be able to understand how we're doing here in New Zealand.
It's really the tech sector, isn't it? It would be a simpler way of putting it rather than ICT. Certainly a lot of sort of general consumers that aren't involved in the tech industry maybe not quite so familiar with the terminologies.
Well, that's right. We've had a number of names for it over the years. It's really the use of computers in the most broadest possible sense, really. From a network point of view, from a user point of view, from the hardware, the software, all of it. The report talks a lot about computer services because it really doesn't know quite what to call these things anymore. Sometimes it's software, but sometimes it isn't. And so it's a catch-all cry for basically what makes up our digital economy, this idea that we can sell stuff overseas and not have to physically move things around the planet and still make money at it.
Which is certainly good for a country like New Zealand. That's a fair way away from
it's essential, isn't it?
The rest of the world,
yeah,
right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we've been talking about it long enough. I went to my first conference on all of this in 2001, the Knowledge Wave Economy Conference. We've been talking about standing on the edge of a new economic idea, and here we are 10 years later, still standing on the edge, waiting for it to arrive, which is a bit disappointing, really.
So do you think New Zealand firms in general aren't very good at sort of pushing ahead technologically?
Oh, no, I think quite the opposite. We do a very good job of making great use of the technology that's available to us. But there are certain limits, and we do struggle. We don't spend a lot on research and development compared with the rest of the world. We certainly don't encourage the development of an ICT or a high-tech sector is worth 5% of our economy at most, which is it's okay. But you think about the New Zealand economy, and we still think about dairy farming. And I have nothing against farmers whatsoever. I just think that we shouldn't be relying 100% on our ability to convert grass into milk powder to pay our way.
Yeah. Well, I guess the farmers are relying on technology as much as anyone else now. And Chris, you can probably comment on that.
Sure.
I'm sure in the Waikato region, there's a fair percentage of of the income from the region is derived from that sector.
A massive amount. I mean, I was just looking at the figures here, and it says the value of computer and information services exports totaled $659 million last year against imports of $531 million. Well, as a former farming editor as well, I can tell you that during one of the droughts that we had a few years ago, Fonterra's impact was $750 million down
from
that drought. Mm. So, these figures, while they sound impressive, they could be a heck of a lot more impressive.
There's a lot of room to go, isn't there?
There's a lot of room to go. The other thing that I'm wondering about this report, and I haven't read it. I've only read the reports of the report, and what I think is possibly missing from here is things like Weather Digital. and the work they're doing for overseas, surely they should be included in this, but surely they're not when you look at those figures.
Yeah, I guess it depends how you define it, doesn't it? Because I would see their, you know, what Weta does as being very much creative work. But, you know, as you and I were discussing earlier, it relies very much on a huge amount of technology in order for them to deliver that. So, yeah, how do you class these things?
Absolutely.
Mm. Well, I mean, I think what that highlights is that really every business relies very heavily on technology. And those who can put themselves at the forefront technology-wise, you know, are potentially ones that are going to do, you know, better and are going to be more competitive in the global marketplace. And we certainly look at, you know, the things that Weta has achieved. Now, they couldn't have done those things without, you know, really making great use of technology. Mm. And I think, you know, we look across probably every sector in New Zealand, and I can't think of any that, you know, probably can do without technology or couldn't be doing better by making use of technology, you know, more or in a smarter way. What are your thoughts on that point?
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. It's really important, I think, that we give as much emphasis to those areas outside of ICT that are using IT capability that we do to the ICT industry itself. You know, I look at the rural sector, and there's a real divide, I think, between urban use of high tech, you know, and I'm thinking in particular of computing capability and the rural sector, and it's predominantly down to the networks. You know, we've got a real lack of network infrastructure in rural New Zealand, and it's in many respects we're not addressing that problem. You know, we're rolling out this ultra fast broadband network in the cities. In the next few years, I'll be able to get 100 megabits per second symmetrical connection at home, 100 down and 100 up. I'll be able to run the business from my office at home far more efficiently than ever before. Rural New Zealand is going to get 5 megabits a second download speed, maybe one up. And I just think we're missing a real opportunity to turbocharge the rural sector as much as we have done. If you think about what's gone on in the office space in the last few years, why aren't we now turning around and applying that same learning to the rural sector?
Mm.
And the more we can do to help that, the better off we'll be, I think, as a community.
Well, when you look at, you know, how much you know, income that New Zealand derives from that sector, certainly we want to be maximising that. Mm. And I guess, yeah, I mean, there are things going on in those rural communities. Some of them are, you know, putting in their own networks to address needs. Of course, the Rural Broadband Initiative will certainly go some way to addressing those things, particularly as we get 4G rolled out into those sort of areas. I mean, we'll be wanting to see the data cap sort of, you know, increase on those connections, yeah. But they're not you know, over the top at the moment, but it's certainly much cheaper to have a fixed connection than a wireless rural broadband connection.
Oh, that's right.
And we're certainly even seeing in some of those communities, though, that they're you know, the implementation of traditional DSL type connections and so on are reaching more and more places, and even getting up to those faster VDSL speeds. So all hope is not lost, is it?
Oh, no, that's right. I was in Whanganui a couple of weeks ago at their annual TechX Expo and saw the work that a bunch of farmers are doing there to provide fixed wireless connectivity. The landscape is very wrinkly around there. It's very steep hills. The farmers are pretty much isolated a lot of the time, and they're rolling out their own network with InspireNet and doing a fantastic job of connecting up whole communities who've never had access to these kinds of speeds before. And it's not only revolutionising their business, of course. It means the kids can do their homework on the weekends. They've got access to a lot of support from the likes of Fonterra or whoever else is providing services to them that they simply just weren't able to tap into before. So it's really good to see.
And, you know, when we were chatting with ASB recently, you know, they've been rolling out a, you know, they've been doing that trial of, you know, video conferencing. So, you know, if you've got that type of good enough connectivity at your farm, you can, you know, don't necessarily have to wait for the bank manager to come and come out to the farm or visit you, but you can video conference into to wherever he may be.
It's very good.
Kind of good. So, we certainly need more of these things to keep coming in. And it's one of the things I see, you know, within my business, within Guerrilla Technology. Part of my role is, you know, talking to our clients about, you know, how they reinvent their businesses, how they, you know, take use of technology and automate business processes and improve how they how they operate. And it can be a challenging process, you know, where people have had, you know, particular businesses for, you know, certainly if they've been around for some time, and getting them to sort of reimagine, you know, how their business might actually need to be. As the, you know, the business marketplace changes, and it's constantly changing.
That's right.
Particularly due to technology and all sorts of other factors, and it's technology that they need to utilize to get themselves into those places that will ensure their ongoing success. So it's certainly a fun area to be involved in, but it's putting, I think there's a lot of pressure in the current financial climate on on a lot of businesses just trying to get their head around what they should look like longer term. Now, one other area that I guess is government related is the TSO.
Yes.
What does the TSO
stand
for?
The TSO, it's yet another three-letter acronym, I'm afraid. The TSO, those of you with long memories will remember the old Kiwi Share. So back when telecom was first privatised and sold off, at the last minute, somebody realised that when you're selling off a monopoly, you probably want to put some limits on what it can and can't do. And rumour has it, legend has it, that somebody said, oh, what about this telecommunications thing we're selling off? Isn't that kind of important? So they introduced a raft of rules around what telecom at the time could and couldn't do. The three most basic and the most commonly quoted are you always will have free local calling, you'll always have the same price for rural folk that urban folk pay, and you can't put up the price of a line rental more than the cost of living every year. So those were carved in stone, if I remember the ad correctly, from 1991. They would be in perpetuity. That was guaranteed to all New Zealanders.
Forever.
So forever and a day, yes.
Yeah.
And then along came the internet, and telecom screamed blue murder that people weren't just picking up the phone and making a phone call anymore. They were dialing in to this internet thing, and this was absolutely appalling. They should be compensated. And there was, to cut a very long story short, because I've been following this since about 2000, 2001, in the end, we renegotiated the whole thing. The government introduced the TSO, which is a telecommunications service obligation, as a way of ensuring that rural New Zealand didn't get left behind. And then a few years later, we discovered that, in fact, telecom hadn't been spending any of the money on rural New Zealand. In fact, it had not been maintaining the network at all at the level that it said it had. And so we decided we would renegotiate the whole thing again. The government's finally released the discussion paper, and unfortunately, on first pass through, it's a bit of back to the future. The entire thing is predicated on the idea that everybody in New Zealand should have a phone capable of doing voice. There's no mention of broadband. There's no mention of minimum speeds. And so we really run the risk of missing an opportunity to invent a universal service for all New Zealanders to say, you know, you're going to need a broadband internet connection to do a lot of things online for the government in years to come. Already we're seeing Inland Revenue and some of the others come up with services that you can only do online. Mm. If you're going to do that, you need to make sure that everybody has access to the internet, not to a voice service so that you can call a call centre that won't take your call. So it's very important we get this right. Unfortunately, the government's got a lot on its plate. It's rushing through the changes to the GCSB and the telecommunication interception bills. It's also announced it's brought forward a review of the entire telco regulatory regime. These are things that should have taken place after we've decided what the base level service looks like. Unfortunately, we're doing it the wrong way around. So, and I think we're going to miss an opportunity to revamp the TSO for the next decade. It'll be another 10 years before we look at it again.
And should everyday internet users be concerned about what's happening around GCSB? What are the opinions that you've been sharing out there?
Well, we've got major concerns with the GCSB bill itself from a fairly high level. So there are two bills. There's the GCSB bill, which governs how the Communications Security Bureau will operate at the very high level. Traditionally, in years gone by, it was set up to look at the communications of non-New Zealanders and non-permanent residents. So it couldn't spy on New Zealanders, in effect.
Yep.
The government says, well, that needs clarifying because we want to be able to spy on New Zealanders. So they're busy running into trouble there.
Now, looking at that spying on New Zealanders, I mean, it seemed like what they were doing was really, you know, they were, what have they talked about, you know, co-opting staff to help the police.
That's right.
And SIS, where police had legitimate to be maybe monitoring someone particular situation.
Mm.
Now, are we talking about them just legalizing it so that the police can get access to the expertise they need, or do you see it that this bill goes much further than that, and that's the big concern?
That, it is a big concern. It's because the two bills combined go an awful lot further than just that. I've got real concerns because the traditional model is the police with a warrant will go to the telco and say, we need to, you know, that Paul Spain, he said some very dodgy things. We'll have to keep an eye on him. We've got a warrant here from a high court judge. We'll serve the warrant on Vodafone or Telecom or whoever your provider is. Mm. They will provide us with the information. There is no need to involve the GCSB in that process at all. I don't understand what capability the GCSB is bringing to that party, especially given the GCSB bill itself now extends that regime even further and says, well, the GCSB or the police or the SIS will be able to call on not just Vodafone or Telecom or your traditional network managers, but also the over-the-top providers like Facebook or Google or Microsoft.
Skype
and all of that sort of thing. You know, we will serve a notice on all of them. It then goes another step further, and when you introduce the interception bill, it gives the GCSB the right to tell the telcos, oh, I'm sorry, you can't get rid of that piece of equipment on your network. We need it. Or, to go further than that, you're not allowed to make certain changes to your core network infrastructure. And if you do, the GCSB reserves the right to veto certain vendors. Now, it's very hard to tell quite what's driving that, but you do get the impression from reading through some of the heavily redacted stuff that they've put out about this we're talking about making sure that Chinese spy agencies don't get involved in installing equipment in New Zealand. So basically what we'll end up with is a set of limits on the telcos when they go out to tender for a new network provider. And you can imagine
like what we've seen in other markets, Australia.
Which means that take mobile, for instance, the leader in 4G technology in the mobile space is Huawei from China.
Hmm.
And they've got to that position by being cheaper than the other providers, but also by being better in many respects in terms of their capability.
They've been fairly innovative, haven't they?
Yeah. So to turn around and say, well, potentially the GCSB could turn around and say, well, you know, we're a bit unsure about that. No, you can't use Huawei. Well, that's going to put the price up for network deployment. It potentially slows down our ability to get access to the latest and greatest kit. And it puts us uneasily in between the security camp, which is based around the US, our alliance with the US, the UK, Australia and Canada, and our trading partnerships, which these days are very predominantly based around China and Southeast Asia. And so we're really caught in the middle there. It's a real issue. The problem for me is that at the end of the day, the customers will end up paying more for their services in order to allow the GCSB access to the networks in order to spy on New Zealanders. Seems to be the opposite of user pays, really.
Yeah, what do you think about this, Chris? Any thoughts? Which side of the fence are you sitting on?
A couple of thoughts here. I mean, often when you get these bits of legislation rushed through, you get a poor quality result at the end of the day. Things aren't debated properly. All the loopholes aren't picked up. So that's one aspect to it. And the other one is you know, this is kind of like, you know, we are paying the government. Sorry, we elect our government to represent us and all the rest of it. And it's a representative turning around and saying, "Well, we're going to spy on you for your own good and see what you're doing."
Yeah, that's right.
It's kind of very strange situation to be in, really, isn't it?
Mm. Is this enough that this is going to really really hurt them at the next election? Because I'm not hearing a whole lot of people sort of standing up and saying, "Hey, no, this is a great idea. This is exactly what the government should be doing."
Same old.
I'm not hearing anyone in any camp, you know, really talking that
way. Same old, same old. People don't understand it. Mm. And what you don't understand, you can't debate, you know, logically and clearly and precisely, can you?
Yeah.
Do you think the government understand what they're doing in this case? Are they getting outside international pressure? Do you think that's where it's coming from?
There's a lot
behind
of pressure
this,
being
behind
brought.
The scenes. It's being they're being, you know, put under considerable pressure,
pushed
by,
along.
Yeah.
And we really are. There's this old world, new world issue going on here, where I get the impression anyway that the GCSB and its supporters are very much in the camp of, well, we're on the side of the Americans. Now, with all the stuff coming out of Europe and the US about PRISM, about just how far this file, this information sharing regime goes, and also what they'll use that information for, it wasn't very many years ago that New Zealand got dragged into a legal stoush between Airbus and Boeing. Airbus had bid for a big Middle Eastern contract. Boeing had gone to the US government and said, we need to see Airbus's bid. Now, we are part of the, I don't want to use the term military-industrial complex, I'm sure there's a better way of putting it, but we're a strategic asset for the Americans, therefore you should help us out. And the Americans did. They gave Boeing information on Airbus's bid, gleaned in no small part from New Zealand's Echelon spy station down in Waihopai. Now, when the Europeans found out about this, they went nuts, of course, quite rightly so. Naturally. And it ended up in a massive, nasty court case, went to the World Trade Organization, the whole noise. It was full on. My question is, what role were we playing in all of that, given that I would put the Americans and the Europeans fairly equally in terms of our relationship with them, and yet our security apparatus is still built around this this one world view that we must support the Americans over everybody else. And I'm just not sure that it fits with everything else we're doing here in New Zealand these days. Yeah. I mean, there are a whole raft of concerns around it, particularly when you get into the level of encryption and security. If Xero, for example, comes up with a way of securing customers' files that the GCSB cannot break, it then has to make that available to the GCSB. They'll be in breach of that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Now, you know, how do you turn around and say to your American customer base, yes, your files are perfectly safe and secure, except for the New Zealand government, because we've given them access to it, of course. You know, I imagine that would be rather difficult for Rod and Co. to sell their services overseas. And that is the risk we're running here. We're actually ahead of the curve, certainly ahead of a lot of the other countries in the world in terms of just how much involvement the government security bureaus will have in our online communications.
Yeah, it's certainly not not sounding like a great move at this stage.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's hope that things progress in a good direction going forward. But there aren't a whole lot of indications that we're going to solve these things. I guess at this stage, the government hasn't really got things quite across the line yet. Anyway, they've got to do a bit of convincing. So this thing may not. The new bill may not go through anyway.
That's just it. And it's the same people making the noise that usually make the noise about these sorts of things, i.e. the Greens and so on. Mm. I guess as it gets further down the track and we understand the implications a bit more, we might see more people making noise. But, yeah.
You've got to be quick. You know, as you say, there's a very short window of opportunity to get involved, and public submissions are already closed, but there's still time to bring pressure to bear on MPs, particularly amongst the support parties, because they're wavering quite significantly on this.
Mm. Now, new gadgets and bits and pieces. Now, one bit that's not super new is Microsoft's Surface RT, but what they did recently announce was a bit of a price drop. So that's dropped $150 US. I think in the New Zealand market, we're talking just over $200. So that's their base price for their Surface RT tablet, which, of course, comes with Microsoft Office as well, $499 New Zealand. For a what is it, a 10.1 inch screen.
I want to say one, but I think you might be right. It might be five.
Yeah, one of those two.
Big screen.
Blank moment, and I don't have a ruler here to measure one. But $499, including Office, which I think somebody was saying was around $300 to go out and buy a copy of Office these days.
That's right.
Is that going to be compelling enough for these to sort of start moving a little bit quicker in the market? What's your thought, Paul?
I'm going to say that I think at that price it might even tempt me, and I'm a hardcore iPad user. So, I run my entire operation these days off an iPad with a keyboard. The idea that looking at this one here in the office, it's really quite gorgeous. Mm. I'd certainly have to give it a go because it's, what's an iPad these days? It's about $1,200, $1,300 all up.
Well, I mean, it depends at the level you go, and you certainly don't have to go in at that sort of level. But at $499, I think it's extremely competitive.
It's on par with a mini iPad, isn't it?
You're less than...
Yeah, there's less than $100 price difference. Yeah. In fact, it's about, what is it, about $40 price difference, I think, with the iPad mini.
That's right. That's right. And you get an awful lot more hardware for your buck for that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. So, yeah, I think that's pretty tempting. And what are your thoughts on the Surface there, Chris?
I think that's a great price. It's 10.6-inch clear Type HD.
Oh, there you go. All right, so, yeah.
That's a great price. And
I'm getting old.
I think, you know, when you compare what a Surface can do compared to what a iPad or even an Android can do, you know, there's no competition really.
Well, I think it depends what you want to do on it. I mean, undoubtedly, the app catalog, you know, we were talking about this last week. I think, Apple are up to 900,000 apps in their app store. I mean, there are apps that you will only get on one platform or another, and more often than not, the platform that's got something that others don't have is iOS. And then, I mean, these days mostly on Android, but there is definitely some gaps still on the Windows side, right?
Sure. And I mean,
I guess you've got the flip side, which is Microsoft Office being included, which you can't get on any other tablet.
Yeah, and you've got USB ports.
You know. I'm all wireless, you know. Yeah. I'm not too worried about the ports these days.
Yeah, but you know, you've got media, you've got stuff on hard drives, you've got, you know.
I Wi-Fi it all, you know. I'm bathing in it. These days.
But it's certainly, it is convenient though. Having, you know, you've got that USB port, you could plug in a traditional peripheral, you could plug in a printer or a keyboard or a mouse or whatever, digital camera and so on. So, I think at that price point, it makes it pretty competitive.
Oh, it does.
It really does come with a keyboard at that price point, but, there's not an iPad with a keyboard at that price. I think they'll do well, and no doubt we're going to see some new versions of the Surface products later on in the year. I certainly think on the Pro side we'll see that next generation. I don't think they've made any pricing changes on the Surface Pro, but I would think within the next sort of 3 to 4 months we'll see a bit of a refresh coming down there, and hopefully we'll get the sort of 3G option and so on in the New Zealand market.
That's exactly right, and it will be interesting to see how well they do given Android and Apple's just sheer dominance of this market to date. You know, there's got to be another alternative out there, and it'd be great to see somebody come along and offer it.
Yep, well, that's definitely a space to watch, but I think their sales are going to pick up pretty considerably with that sort of price drop. Now, Chris, tell us about Code Avengers.
Yeah, well, I just got this in my inbox and was just reading it a bit earlier, but there's a guy in Hamilton who has, let me just bring it up, who has just been overseas last week, and his name is Michael Walmsley. He is a Waikato University graduate, if I've got that right from my memory, and he's been at Code Camp in California, running Code Camp for teenagers, basically, in a Californian school.
Teaching them how to be programmers.
Absolutely. So this goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the evening on the podcast about exporting our know-how. Because this guy was over there, happened to be at some sort of event, and while he was over there, he arranged to hook up with some other guy that he knew, and hey presto, there he is in a Californian classroom on a two-day coding course. So, you know, all power to his elbow, really. It's just the sort of thing that we should be seeing more of.
Absolutely.
And there's a potential to take a business like that and to you know, I guess really grow that to all over the world if we've got if we've got all the smarts, we're good at we're good at teaching, and there's a shortage in other markets, then hey, that's good.
Mm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I'd like to see a lot more of that in New Zealand schools as well. You know, it's all too often we use iPads in the classroom or this kind of thing. We're really not yet at the point of integrating it fully in the curriculum, and there's an awful lot of discussion going on about how best to do that, and I think the sooner we get on with that, the better, really. You know, the schools that are doing it are seeing tremendous results for their kids. It's great.
Of course, the Institute of IT Professionals, which was formerly the Computer Society, is doing things like this, special courses.
Yeah.
I just find it quite interesting. In the press release that he sent out, it says currently only 1 in 10 American schools teach students how to code. Well, that's probably, I don't know the figures for New Zealand, but I would think that's pretty big compared to what we're doing here.
That's probably about right, isn't it? And really? And the younger schools.
It'd be pretty all high schools would do it in New Zealand, surely. But it comes down to whether individuals are interested. No?
No, I don't know the.
I got taught to program when I was in
certainly they in have computer and club rooms that was a little and things while like ago. That. But yeah. I think the amount of actual coding going on. Mm. You know, I looked at the high tech youth network set up out in South Auckland the other day, and it's fantastic. But it's not built around coding as such. It's built around design and media and things of this sort. So it's really a lab. Using computers rather than for computers and for computing, and it's quite a different emphasis.
Oh, maybe, I think that's where a lot maybe of my school was very cutting edge.
Might so well be.
Shout out to Burnside High School in Christchurch. I hope you're still teaching people how to program.
You were special, Paul.
We had a lot of geeks actually at that school, and there were some extremely talented developers. Actually, I remember so. Be curious how well some of them are doing these days. Now, a little bit of sad news this week. One of our retailers, I suppose you'd call it, Ubi, have shut down 3 out of their 4 Auckland stores and their Dunedin store. Now, they've been, I guess, the main retailer of Apple product here in New Zealand for quite some time. I think they used to be Magna Mac was That's the brand right. name, and then they... They renamed after Renaissance Corporation sort of acquired them. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, Renaissance has been in some trouble for quite some time now. Renaissance used to have the exclusive rights to Apple products in New Zealand, but in about, 2006, 2007, they opened that up. You started to see these stores inside a store coming along from Noel Leeming and Bond & Bond, places like that. And so Renaissance has really struggled since then.
Yeah, they were hugely profitable up until that time, weren't they? They did very well as Apple really came into dominance. Particularly the iPod and you know and so on as those products sort of really became just something that everyone had to have. They made huge profits, but of course Apple also entered the market themselves, didn't they? By selling online, so it's made it a whole lot harder for them. But it was a real surprise to me. I'm not sure if either of you were expecting something like that, but to see 3 out of their 4 Auckland stores close, their mall stores in Albany and. Sylvia Park, and they had a store downtown at Britomart that closed.
I don't know if I would have predicted it, but in hindsight, which is always a great thing, when you ever walk into any of those stores, and I've walked into a few of them around the country, they're often quite quiet. And look, I think you probably go there if you want after-sale service, you want somebody that you can chat to about the product before you buy it, if you're not really sure. Probably the guys in our... In our sort of level of tech usage, probably wouldn't need that because we do the research. We buy online or we buy like that because we know what we want. But I'm guessing mum and dad and gran and granddad who are looking for something for Christmas, we'll get that before sales service.
Yeah. They want to get hands on. They want to play with it. Yeah. Have somebody talk them through it.
Yeah.
So would it be fair to say that most people that would have been going into those stores are Apple enthusiasts that would particularly choose to go specifically to an Apple type store because Apple don't have their own retail presence here rather than going into for instance a Harvey Norman that tends to have a section for Apple products would the general public more often run into Apple in those sort of generalist stores?
Well, I think that's probably right. And these days, whenever you go into a JB Hi-Fi or any of these places, somebody usually pounces on you from the Apple stand anyway. I'm not sure what Ubi offered over and above that in terms of service. It certainly wasn't the genius bar that you hear about from the US or even Australia. It was very much a sales environment rather than an Apple marketing environment.
Well, I'm curious whether Apple are going to launch their own sort of presence here, but I imagine if they do, they're not going to have the same sort of number of stores as what we've seen from Ubi. They would tend to have
exclusivity,
very very large scale stores. Yep. Well, not necessarily huge, but depending on where they are, but not necessarily having lots and lots of stores.
Yeah. I mean, how many have they got in Australia now? Is one in Sydney, might be one in Melbourne. That's the sort of scale you could expect at most, I would think. Maybe one in Auckland, one in Wellington. Yeah. You'd be done.
They are quite common in the US in the malls, but they tend to be in the bigger malls there and still bigger stores as well.
Yeah, if they are, it almost sounds like it's a bit too late, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah, as you said before, Chris, I don't know. I'd bother going into one. If I'm going to buy a piece of hardware, I review it. I look it up online. I find out all the specs. I decide which unit I want. I don't necessarily want to talk to a spotty youth who's trying to upsell me on a cable. And I order it online and it's delivered and job done.
And you probably get on the phone to me or Paul or somebody else.
Somebody who can actually spell IT in
the game. Have you seen one of these?
That's right.
Should I buy it?
Yeah, exactly. And that word of mouth thing is far more important to me than... Than going into a shop and having somebody typically, not necessarily the UB shops, but all too often I see people giving the most appalling advice in shops. I watched one shop assistant basically just tell lies about the Kindle when I was in the shop, and I had to rush over to the man and after he'd spoken to this guy and say, he's completely wrong. He's making stuff up. That's not at all how it works or how much it costs or what the books are like. Just, here, have a look at mine. And I made the sale. The shop assistant was useless.
I must admit, I've been in similar situations myself when I've overheard a salesperson talking about something on the shelf. And I just want to leap in and say, hang on a minute.
And I guess that's a reflection of the changing world we're in, right, where people are getting their information not necessarily from, a retail assistant, but they're, researching online, maybe listening to a podcast, getting that sort of specialist knowledge that they need.
Yep.
And then, all right, I'm ready to order. Actually, I'll just do this online, I don't need to necessarily ask a whole lot of questions.
Yep, and social media plays a huge part in that. And I remember having a pivotal moment a few years ago where the dishwasher had died, and instead of Googling for a replacement, I asked Twitter, and I just said, where do I go to buy a dishwasher these days? I had dozens of replies. Some of them were actually quite useful, but most of them were rubbish. within seconds, and it. But as a consumer, as a customer, it really felt like I was tapping into some kind of, much like the three of us sitting here talking about what was going on. It was almost a word of mouth recommendation from friends, and that meant that really guided my buying decision far more vigorously than anybody's websites around it. I thought that
carries
really
a lot more
weight,
doesn't it?
Yeah, it really did.
Yeah,
it really did. And in the end, I followed the advice of Lazy Web, the Twitterati. And saved quite a bit of money, and it was actually quite a lot of fun rather than going onto a website and comparing stats. So it was a real turning point there for me, and I suspect once you've done that, there's no going back, and certainly there's no going in store to to ask somebody questions that they probably don't know the answer to.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I think it's very easy to be disappointed by the knowledge and whatever you get told by retail staff. In some cases, I'm not saying that's always the case, because
there are some
really sharp people out there, and certainly come across a few over the last year or two. Now, talking about smartwatches, now we've talked about some of these in the past on the show. Now, recently we've heard, Pebble have been, sending theirs out to the people that bought them off Kickstarter. And then there was a little bit of a kerfuffle because they were actually selling them in the US through Best Buy to the general public ahead of some of their Kickstarter supporters and pre-purchasers actually getting their
that's not very
their smartwatches, which didn't please a few people. And of course, we've heard that Apple are working away on something, and there's some talk about iWatch keeps popping up. And then the latest one that we've just heard about today is Microsoft apparently testing a translucent aluminium smartwatch.
Yes, doesn't that sound lovely?
Does that sound credible? Translucent aluminium? Is there such a thing?
Sounds like an iPad, doesn't it?
Have you seen Star Trek IV? When Scotty comes up with the formula for transparent aluminium, as he calls it?
Aluminium. Aluminium.
So there you go. They got it from Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's metal all that you Star can Trek. See through just sounds pretty cool to me. So I'd get one just for the look of it. But apparently, Microsoft have taken their smartwatch project and moved it under their Surface team, who of course have come out with some quite nice tablet hardware.
That's right.
So you've got to think maybe these guys could actually come up with something that that, you know, stands out alongside an Apple type product. And Microsoft are getting pretty good at the old software games. So what do you think? Could they deliver something good here?
Yeah,
got the brand to do it, or if Apple came up with a product that was equally as good, would they sell 10 times as many?
Well, I wonder how much of this is driven just off the back of Microsoft not being first out with a tablet in the standard format we've seen today, and we've got to be first to be the next one. I don't know that a watch format is actually all that it would be cracked up to be. You know, it's a small footprint, or if it isn't, then it's too big to wear. What's the battery life going to be like? The screen's tiny. I don't know how you input content to it. You know, it strikes me that we've moved on beyond. It's one of those, much like video calling. Everybody wants it, and then when you get it, you go, you know, that's actually not for me.
Not something you use all the time.
You know, it's a nice to have. It's a gimmick, and I do wonder about that with the whole watch market. I would expect to see them get more into televisions in the home before I would expect to see a watch.
And that certainly seems to be an era where, you know, from what we're hearing, Apple are putting a fair degree of focus, and there's been some more rumor and speculation around that from Apple, and you know, of course, Microsoft and others working on consoles that. You know, really designed to supplant the, you know, traditional types of TV watching. All right, so if it's not the smartwatch for you guys, what do you think about Nokia's new announcement with the Nokia Lumia 1020?
Let me add it.
Now, this is the one with the big the camera sensor, which is a 41-megapixel camera sensor. So, you know, in theory, from what we're hearing, it's not just a high-definition sensor, but it actually can deliver good quality photos. And we're used to the number of megapixels in cameras and phones. Just, you know, the numbers keep going up, but, you know, the quality actually not necessarily lining up with it. But, you know, from what we're hearing, there's some pretty good optics, and the result is supposedly pretty good. Now, Chris, you've certainly got some thoughts on this one.
Look, I've tried nearly every Nokia phone out since they teamed up with Microsoft, and they just keep getting better and better. I've got using a 920 at the moment, Lumia 920, and it's just fantastic. And
they did some good stuff with the camera there, didn't they?
Absolutely.
It was the first smartphone to have optical image stabilization, which we're, you know, sort of used to in, you know, the high end, you know, digital SLRs and some of the higher end cameras. But they brought that into the phone. Do you really think that makes a big difference in terms of the picture quality and so on?
Yeah. The photos on that are far superior to, you know, other platforms that I've used. Yeah, so I mean, you know, what they're proposing to roll out in the next model is just more of the same but better. And
do people want to carry around a phone that's a bit bigger and chunkier because it has to be, you know, to be able to fit this lens in it?
I think you get used to whatever you've got. I mean, you know, we've seen some of the big Galaxy Note and some of those other things. You know, if it does what you want it to do. Yeah, I mean, I suspect for some people, although it's a phone, it won't be used primarily as a phone. It will be used for other things, and it might happen to ring once or twice a day.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, I think it's certainly something we've got used to, is the fact you don't need to carry a camera around with you because your smartphone can do it. But I find I'm often disappointed when I haven't brought my digital SLR or brought another camera because a smartphone, you know, just doesn't have a zoom. That's the main thing. There's no real zoom. So, you know, my thought is if this could actually handle that sort of zoom side of it well by making use of those extra megapixels to be able to deliver something decent, that could be quite useful. How about you, Paul?
Yeah, I like the idea of having my camera with me at all times. Mm. You know, the camera you use most often is the one in your pocket, and I have my phone with me constantly. And I've never really been that thrilled with the iPhone or even the Samsung Galaxy ranges cameras. So it'd be great to see a bit more out there, and perhaps you're right, Chris. It'll be a camera that you carry in your pocket that you use as a phone periodically, rather than the other way around. With this kind of capability, you know, I'd be wondering why I'd even have a digital camera at all on top of that. So yeah, more power to them, really.
Yep. All right. Now, just a couple of other things before we finish up. Now, IDG have taken over PC World, Reseller News, Computer World, and CIO magazines here in New Zealand. Now, they've all, now those have obviously left Fairfax. Now, they're being published going forward in in a digital form, aren't they? We're not going to see magazines anymore?
No, it certainly looks like they are going to be online only. Now, this is something that we promoted back when I was at Computer World, nearly a decade ago now. Goodness me, can't be that long. That we should be online only. I mean, it's an IT publication. It seems to make sense that the website get the most resourcing. Fairfax was never willing to do that and proved themselves incompetent when it came to publishing online, full stop, as far as I can tell. So it'll be great to see IDG Australia hopefully put in the resource to be able to deliver IT news online and do it properly.
Well, that's, I guess, the bit we don't know is how how much resource they're going to put into New Zealand and how much they're just going to take Australian stories and fire them at us. So there's a fair bit of unknown. Now, interestingly, along with this, and I'm sure it's I'm guessing it's purely coincidental, but PC World magazine, the original PC World out of the US, has finally pulled the plug on print editions as well.
Yep,
and has also gone online.
Yeah,
or do you think they're just copying what we're doing down here?
No, I suspect that's been in train for a while. I mean, really, all of these publications were born out of a need to educate the market around computers. These days, of course, you're basically born with some kind of computing device in your hand. So the idea that you need to train people up and have a hard copy item sitting there next to the keyboard whilst you fumble around trying to work it all out, we've long since moved on past that.
What about those days of magazines that would have some code in it that you would key in so you could run a game on your computer?
Yes. Oh, look, now you're showing your age. I'll tell you about my ZX81 experience shortly, and then we'll all fall asleep.
ZX81.
So, hey, 1K of RAM. And you tell the kids today and they don't believe you.
Yep.
No, it had no RAM, actually. That was the 16K RAM pack in the back of it. It was awesome. No. Every time you finished programming something, it would get warm and fall off.
That's right.
And you'd just lose everything. There was no hard drive.
Don't touch the RAM pack.
Don't touch the RAM pack. Oh, my God. Oh, it's too late. It's gone.
I think it's hard for people today to imagine that there could ever have been a computer that didn't just
that didn't
save,
do anything.
That didn't actually say you couldn't save anything.
No.
You couldn't just press save and for it to save it to the hard drive or anything
record
like that.
Record it onto a tape.
You had to go through a very convoluted process with a tape deck.
I know, and then it would never work. You'd play it back, and the computer would sit there and listen to the screeching like a modem, and nothing would ever work. But
that was glory days. Glorious.
That was the peak.
Wasn't
that was
it?
The peak. Absolutely.
And it was actually quite cutting edge.
Yeah, it was quite frightening just how cutting edge it was. But you just don't need to do that these days, do you? I mean, the iPad ships without a manual. You just open it up, you press go, and you start in.
And you can give it to a two-year-old, and the two-year-old can work it out.
Exactly right. And my kids, that's what they expect from a computing device. It's almost transparent. They don't use a computer. They play Angry Birds, or they do their homework. Mm. But it just happens to be on a computer. So the need for that kind of publication has changed dramatically, and unfortunately the publication hasn't changed with it.
Sure, I think those publications are also about creating community, and now we're in a situation where community is online.
That's
in
right.
Forums,
yep.
Through Facebook, whatever it might be, and the magazines have got to move to that format
they
as well.
They absolutely do, yeah. And the name, the names alone, Computer World, PC World, they limit their market. Really, these were, as you say, Chris, you're quite right, it was all about community. It was about the IT people who work behind the scenes on these things. And it was always important to me as an editor that that we weren't limited by the title. And it was really more about information and ICT or high tech. So I think in Australia they've dumped the PC World name and they're calling it the Gear Guide. The Good Gear Guide, I think, is the new name for PC World over there. Because it's not just about PCs. It's about phones. It's about laptops. It's about tablets. It's about all of it.
All sorts of gadgets. Now, talking of gadgets, now this is one we talked about a couple of weeks back. But Chris, you walked in here tonight with the Ultimate Ears Boom or UE Boom. Now this is a little cylindrical speaker that you can connect to via Bluetooth, and or you can plug a cable in as well. But everyone was we sort of jumped actually. When Paul dropped some tunes through it earlier, what's your pick on it from just a volume perspective and sound quality perspective?
It's fantastic. This arrived in my at my desk at work today, and I got a text to say it was there, so I drove by the office and picked it up because I'm actually on leave this week. And really just had a chance to boot it up, play it here when we got here, and as you say, it's for, was it $299?
Yeah, and I've seen it. I think a chunk cheaper than that at JB Hi-Fi as well. Sure. So I think you can probably get it at a lower price.
Right. So I'll be going to buy one of those.
It's not cheap, but you get what you pay for, right?
Yeah, yeah. The sound quality is gorgeous. It's painlessly easy to use, and it looks fantastic.
Well, and you can just link thinking, a couple of them together and get even louder if you need. We're still waiting for a second one to arrive, actually, so we can have a play with that.
Well, two minutes ago, we were talking about getting information onto your PC using a tape recorder, and look, we've all come from that analog age.
Yeah,
it still astounds me. I know, you know, iTunes has been around for a few years now. It just still astounds me where we've come from in such a short time.
Yeah,
and how a piddly little bit of information on my phone.
Yeah.
Zap through the air can be picked up by a tube that looks like about, you know, height of two toilet rolls stuck together, and it can whack out some awesome sounding music.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it? It's witchcraft. It really is.
Well, we're using these now for presentations. When someone's hooked up their laptop to a projector, you can just link into one of these either Bluetooth or with a cable.
Yeah,
because laptop speakers are not known for being particularly loud. But you've got to give a presentation to a group of people, use one of these, and my wife absolutely loves rocking music through that whenever we are at home or we head away for the weekend as we did last weekend, and we didn't have to take some huge device with us. I don't think it needed charging all weekend. It's really cool. Now, one other thing around charging, other device that I've been playing with for a few weeks now, the new MacBook Air. Now, we talked about the extra battery life and so on coming to with the next generation, the fourth generation of Intel core processors, and of course the MacBook Air was one of the first ones to have it. But just before we kicked in, I showed you guys both the battery indicator on the MacBook Air and asked both of you, how long do you think how much battery life is there left? And it was just set up with the visual depiction. You can set it to show how long.
Yeah.
And I think what were you guys guessing? You were sort of saying, minutes. Oh, one gar, you probably got 10 minutes or
10
so.
10 minutes or so, yeah.
Enough time to log off smoothly and get out.
So it's been sitting on one bar since before we started the show. Now, that bar's gone from black to red. At that stage, it was indicating on its one bar that we had an hour 30 left with just one bar. Now, after 40 minutes has gone by of sometimes not using it, sometimes using it, and it's saying I've still got more than an hour,
still over an hour,
hour left.
That's what it should be like, isn't it?
So that's just a taste of what these new new processors are delivering. We are going to be reviewing a bunch more of these over the next few months as we see more of them going forward. But if you're looking for something right now, or you're after a Mac, then the new MacBook Air delivers some pretty good battery life. The frustrating thing with Apple, though, is we don't know when there's going to be a new MacBook Pro, for instance.
Yeah.
And so,
you want to know in advance. You just have to
guess, and if you need one,
you
just have to go and buy one and know that possibly in a week's time, but maybe in 3 months' time, there's going to be one with potentially twice as much battery life, or at least 50% more battery life. So,
and it won't look anything like that one.
It's a little bit maddening, if you need a MacBook Air, if you're after that sort of really ultra thin and light machine, then they're across the line already with the new chips, and it's pretty awesome.
I always tell people it's 3 months out of date by the time it hits the shelf anyway.
That's right. There's no point waiting. Just go and get one.
Just go and get one. If you want one, get one.
Don't be
disappointed.
Never wait, because there's always going to be something else. Always another one.
So, that's it. That really wraps us up for this week. So, thank you, Paul. Thank you, Chris, for joining us on the podcast. Now, where do we track you down online, Paul? You're on Twitter?
I am. I'm on Twitter almost obsessively, some would say. At Paul Brislin is the easiest way to find me.
Nice and easy.
Nice and easy.
And you'll get me on Twitter as well at Chris Gardner NZ. That's Chris, C-H-R-I-S, Gardner, G-A-R-D-N-E-R-N-Z. You'll also find my stuff on Stuff, at normalwaikato.co.nz under the technology section, which is hidden at the moment in business.
All right. Oh, very good. And, of course, you can track me, Paul Spain, down on Twitter, at Paul Spain, and around all the other usual social networks like Google Plus and so on. And NZ Tech Podcast is online at nztechpodcast.com, facebook.com/nztechpodcast, and NZ Tech Podcast on Twitter. Do look out for us in those places and Google Plus too. We'll catch you on the next episode. See ya.